Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Our speaker is Paul P. from Philadelphia. Home group is the Underground Group.
Hello, my name is Paul, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm
truly grateful to be here tonight. I'd like to thank Paul for the intro, and Sarah for extending this invitation for me to come out here and speak with you guys, and you guys for being here, and of course, the Philly crew to make it up here and support me tonight. I'm truly blessed. So I guess, real simply said, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a sacred place for me. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of sponsorship and placing my hand in the hand of God, I can say that I'm a recovered alcoholic. I've recovered from the hopeless state of mind and body. And if you're like me, you can understand how much of a miracle that is. And I don't use that term lightly. I actually hated the word miracle. But it truly is a miracle, and I am blessed. And because of that experience I've had with Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to show my gratitude. And I have to show with action, whether it means sponsoring, taking a guy through the 12 steps, lending a hand to a newcomer, giving somebody a ride, or coming here to speak. You know, I will go to any lengths for sobriety, and I'll go to any lengths for Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, tonight is a special night. On top of that, all because of the season. I guess the best way to say it would be that I come from a very large Italian family, and they don't need much of a reason to throw a party, you know, or to cook a lot of food and to eat a lot of food and to get together, and there's no bigger or better reason for them than for Christmas and New Year's, and my whole life, especially like the last 10 years before I found Alcoholics Anonymous, this was the worst time of year. You know, I lie and avoid and manipulate and run like to the best of my ability. And even if my game is tight, there's no way that I'm avoiding certain family members at this time of the year. And I hated it. I hated getting together. It was just constant like questions and answers, and I was lying. I knew there was going to be suffering involved, and if you weren't talking to me, I was wondering why, and if you were, I was just asking you to please leave me alone. But I knew no matter what, I was at least going to see my mom and a few others on Christmas Day, and I dreaded it. And today, because of the relationship I have with God, and without that relationship, I wouldn't have any others. There is no better place to be on any season, any day of the year than with my family. They are a gift. I was given a lot of gifts that I just never was able to unwrap. I was never able to see as a gift. I always thought they were curses. And my family being one of them. And like I said, there's no better place to be on Christmas morning than with my family. And there's no better way to start this, I guess, week of celebration for me. I have at work today, but then I have off for the rest of the weekend than to be here with you guys and to talk about, my journey, my experience, strength, and hope. But, even before, before I started drinking, I had about 12 years of sobriety. I went from 0 to 12 without a drink. And that time, I still hated the holidays, It didn't matter. I battled with this core belief that I didn't have any value. And even today, when looking at inventory and trying to find truth and discover truth, my sponsor will remind me before we move on to the next one, as I'm so anxiously to move on to the next resentment. He'll say, "Yeah, Paul, before we move on, no matter what comes of this, you still have value." And I'm grateful for that. But I had this belief, this core belief. I had no value. I had no worth. And I carried that into everything. Like so many other alcoholics that I hear, I just didn't think I was enough. You know, wasn't this enough, that enough? And because of that, I never wanted to like either be seen or be heard. And I, like I said before, if you weren't paying attention to me, I was a little bit scared about that. And if you were, then I was scared about that too. This self-centered fear that drove me in life. Drove me to rely on you guys to make me worth something. So if you asked me something, I told you what I thought you wanted to hear out of this self-centered fear I had. So I just told nothing but lies. I told my truth or what I wanted to be the truth. And I asked you guys to make me have value. Wasn't until I went through these steps, until I looked at myself honestly through this inventory, that I was able to strip away these lies so I get down to who I am between me and God. And who I am and what I am and my value does not rely upon your views of me. It does not mean that I don't want, like Sarah, to text me and say, could you come up at next Christmas and speak again? Or that I don't want everyone to say, Paul, great job. Or I don't have the fear of not being liked. But it doesn't push me or drive me to the place that it used to. You know, the book talks about us being driven by 100 different forms of fear. And I try to look honestly at myself all the time. I try to explore fear. And, I don't think I've hit like 25 or 30 different fears. I might have found 25 or 30 fears in 100 different ways, but I don't think I've come close to discovering 100 different fears. And I'm driven by these things. And everyone has fears, but I'm alcoholic and I just think a little bit differently. It just works a little differently with me. And again, like God has put gifts in my life and I have members of my family, again, who are spiritual people and show me what it's like to truly have faith. To know that God has got me, that God, I have a loving and caring God that will care for me. One of the examples is like my nephew. He's going to be 4 in March, and I remember when he was born a premature baby, and they were worried that the sutures in his head were going to close before his brain was fully developed, and scared the heck out of me. And quickly, I got online and I was like Googling stuff, and I was seeking out all the information that I could find that was out there, and I was finding where the best places are, and all discovering all the treatments for this. And I contacted my sister, and I was like, Jess, don't worry about it. You know, CHOP, Children's Hospital, is like one of the best in the world, and this is truly a cosmetic disease or problem, and they can fix it. It doesn't necessarily mean he's going to have any like learning disability. And she thanked me. You know, like I was probably giving her any news that she didn't know already. I'm sure the doctor didn't say, your son might have a funny looking head. See you later. But I still like felt the need to do this and seek out this information and come to her. And she said, thank you. And she said, you know what, Paul, but, you know, God can like, you know, just open up those plates in his head and put them together and make them look just perfect. And that's my sister. That's spirituality. That's having God dependency, God reliance. She just has that. Certain people in my life, they just have that. I don't have that. I don't go naturally to God. I go to lying, cheating, dishonesty, all those things. That's what I bring to the table naturally. And other people just do that. My cousin, at 15, he told me that there's no room for fear in a heart filled with faith in God. And he said this to me at his mother's funeral. As I tried to reach out to say, hey, Michael, if you're scared, you need anybody, give me a call. And that's what he told me. He knows that there's nothing that God's will has in store for him that God cannot protect him from so long as he stays close, performs his work to the best of his ability. But not me. Fear is something that consumes me. And it has from the start. You know, I was afraid from birth, it feels like. You know, school was the worst thing on earth to me. It didn't matter if it was like the last day of my senior year or the first day of first grade. I was scared to death to go. I remember lying awake at night, being afraid to fall asleep because I knew in the morning I had to go to school, and to be afraid to not fall asleep in time to get enough sleep to be awake at school. I was so consumed with this that I knew what was on the television when my parents were up at night. Like, it's Monday night, so I know my stepfather's watching Monday Night Football, so he's going to be up late. So I'm not the last one asleep in my household. So I know I'm not, there's nobody getting more sleep than me. You know, I knew if, like, I heard, like something in the world today takes everything you've got. Like, I knew the Cheers theme because I knew it's 9 o'clock Thursday, so they're going to be up for another, like, half hour. And then I think, like, Night Court came on next, and I knew what was going on. So I knew, like, people were up. You know, I still have time to fall asleep and get enough. And I woke up, and I went into school, and I just saw these people who, like, I thought hated me. And I spent so much energy and time just studying what people were doing. You know, how do you react? How do you move? What am I supposed to laugh like? What am I supposed to be sound like? What am I supposed to be like looking like? Or wear my hair like? Or listening to? Or watching? You know, all these things. And again, like I said before, God forbid you don't talk to me. But I don't know which one was worse if you started talking to me. Because once again, I would just be like consumed with this fear. I'd ask you guys to like, please, like, let me know what I have to do. Let me know what I have to do to be a part of. Didn't matter if I was with my family at the dinner table, I wasn't a part of. Didn't matter if I was with my best friends, I wasn't a part of. If I was on the team or if I was the captain of the team, I just didn't feel included. It was just different. And I'm pretty sure that alcohol at some point saved my life because it was the first thing that just settled me down. From an early age, I was in therapy. I was a big cutter. I was cutting myself at 30 years old, but I did not like myself from the start. And I know it wasn't like the first time that that I got drunk, but the first time that I recognized that I was getting some kind of solution to what was going on in me through alcohol. I had an older sibling, and I had friends who had older siblings, so we were always able to hang out with the older people. And I was in, like, sixth grade, and I remember I was, like, you know, knocking a few back and kind of being a wallflower. And I ran, and I, like, did a flip on this couch, and I landed on this girl, and everybody laughed. And I was like, whoa, it's on. This is good. And sure enough, like, I didn't want to be without alcohol. And I was like, this is why this happened. So that night, I remember going home and grabbing a thermos and going down to the liquor cabinet and filling it up with whatever my parents had the most of. And I guess I had, like, a quality for theft from the beginning because I knew, like, it's less than what I was before, so I was pouring stuff in it. And I was mixing and matching, and it probably tasted horrible. And I don't even remember drinking from it all that much. But I knew it was there, so I had a sense of comfort. And that's what I was interested in from then on, you know. I got in a lot of trouble as a direct result. I went to, like, the bad kid camp. I went to a couple weeks out in the woods. I went from the suspension and detention to being expelled. I hopped around a lot, and it was all because I just wanted to drink, just wanted to booze. And, you know, luckily for me, I made it out of high school. And another God-given gift was the ability to run pretty fast at the same time, like, having a soccer ball on my feet. And I was able to kick it far and hard. And, you know, I didn't have to work very much at it. And it was just laid in my lap. And along with that came the opportunity to go to college for free. And I was awarded a full tuition remission for a soccer scholarship to a university in Philadelphia. And I was so scared that I didn't even apply. It was like May of my senior year, and the athletic director contacted my mom saying, we have your son's name on the short list of athletic scholarships, but I don't know where his application is. And my mom's like, did you apply? And I was like, oh, yeah, they probably lost it. And my mom drove it in the next day, and I got in. And from the start, the second I was out of the house, I was off on my own, and I didn't really care about too much anything. And the coach knew quickly that I was going to be a problem. And before the season started, I was a red shirt. And meaning that I still had another year of eligibility, and they don't give, like, red shirt soccer players, like, they don't redshirt soccer players. You know, it's like football, you got a stud quarterback, you might redshirt him so he can play later. Like, they don't waste the scholarship on somebody to redshirt him in soccer. And before the season was even over, I was off the team. The scholarship taken away, and, you know, here I was. I registered again for the next semester. I didn't go. My parents dropped me off at school, and I, like, then had a buddy pick me up and drive me back about 6 blocks from where I was living. And I was talking to my mom on the phone saying school's going great, and I was, like, around the corner. And around, like, March of the spring semester, my dad got this, like, $22,000 bill from the university saying, you know, that we owed him this money. And my dad's like, what's going on? I was like, oh, nothing. Just messing up at the bursar's office. You know, they can't keep anything straight. And I hadn't been to school once. And, you know, that came, you know, they figured out the truth that one pretty quick. And my parents were separated. And my dad's like, I'm going to straighten this kid out. He brings me up to live with him. And I lasted about 4 months. And he was like, all right, you better get going. And I head back to Philadelphia. And again, I got lucky. I got lucky a lot. And I had an uncle who was an actor. And they needed some help on some shows. There weren't many young actors. And he got me a role in a play. And I thought, why not? You know, I've been faking everything and lying and doing well at it my whole life. Like, I might as well get paid for it. And I did pretty well. I jumped right in. And, you know, I got recognition, and I got good write-ups, and I got awards. And you know, it's like it's dangerous to give an award to an alcoholic. You know, it instantly goes to your head. And, you know, I thought this was fantastic. And I remember I won this award, this local Philadelphia award, and then the next season the theater company hired me back, and I was to play Sebastian in Twelfth Night. And before we even got through the table readings, I was out. Missed the first three rehearsals, and the next two I showed up drunk. Quickly got into another role before we got going, kicked out. 3 times this happened, consecutive, back. And I was 18 or 19, and I was a member of the Equity Theaters Union. So they contacted my parents because I was a minor. I was going to be removed from the union. And this was kind of like my two employers scenario. And they knew that, like, I think your son has a substance abuse problem. And this was not news to my mom. And she tried to get me some help, and I didn't want anything to do with that again. So I was off. And I managed to somehow get things together. I moved around. I went back to school. I finished school. And I did what all actors do. I became a server. And this was perfect for me. You know, today I actually, like, I got to say that I still serve tables. I still wait tables. I manage a restaurant. And I hated this part of my life for so long. And today, like, because of God's grace, because of this relationship I have with a higher power, I love what I do. And I know it's not me. I always looked down upon it. I always looked at it as a failure of dreams that shattered, dreams that were lost. But no, it's like there's nothing better that I could do to let people have fun. You know, they come to the place I work, and I can hopefully show them a good time, a good meal, or whatever it might be. But I love to serve in all areas of life, I guess. You know, I came into AA thinking I was God, and I'm leaving as a server. I'm feeling much better about myself. It's weird. But, you know, I became a server and a bartender, and I loved it. It was perfect for me. You know, I hopped around. I was acting. I was living in Philadelphia, D.C., Atlantic City, New York, all over. I spent a couple months in L.A. You know, and that's what I did. That's what, like, one of the things that hit me over the head when I was, like, first in rehab, like, talking about, like, those things I was told, like, you know, one of which people, places, and things. And I was, like, trying to, like, remember they wanted to ask me to write my history, and then, like, told me, like, to avoid people, places, and things. And I was like, I think I tried this one, and it didn't work, but all right, I'm going to start avoiding people, places, and things. But I'd been everywhere, and I'd done everything, and it didn't matter who I was with or where I was. I was just going to keep doing the things I did. And I worked a lot. I bartended a lot because it was perfect for me. It was an open bar. It was cash. There was a big thing called a void button. I knew the manager's code. so I could just void at will, steal what I wanted, and go on. And there's always extra hours, and I was always afraid to not work. And I almost, like, I think I let that, like, be an excuse for, like, all my shortcomings, was that I'm working a lot, so might as well skim off the top. And I worked that out because I was afraid of having, you know, days off. If I had to have, like, more than one day off a week, it couldn't be consecutive days because I was broke. I was waking up in weird places, like the drunk tank or else, like, parks near my house. You know, I was working up, waking beat up, just scared, not knowing what was going on, where I was. So I always tried to work as much as I could. And I would feel the heat, you know, I would, like, be stealing a lot, and I would feel like they got to be on to me by now, like, half the register is gone, and I would, like, quick get up and jump to another restaurant. I'd work at all these different places, stealing all sorts of money, drinking all their booze, and, you know, not really caring too much about it. Another big catastrophe happens. I re-injured my face. I was in a car accident way back when, drunk driving, and shattered my face. I did it again in the fall, and I remember I woke up in Hahnemann, and my family's there, and I told them some crazy lie with my, kind of mumbled a crazy lie because my jaw was wired shut. I had no idea what happened, and I told them that, like, I was helping my landlord move, and he dropped a dresser on me, and I live above my landlord. So literally, like, my family was in my apartment, and I'm coming home, and I'm coming up the steps, and my mom just stopped at the door and, like, knocked and asked my landlord what happened. And he's like, no, I found your son at the bottom of the steps, like I do all the time. It's like he was drunk, and I took him to the hospital. And I was there, that was. And, you know, I go in, and there's, like, all my family, and there's this big intervention. Like I said, my family's a gift. They, like, love me no matter what. They teach me how to love. Just like AA does, you know, and there they all are with all those letters and this intervention guy, and I don't care, I'm not listening. And I, like, agreed to, like, go and stay with my mom in Atlantic City, and before the first night at her house was even over, I was into her purse, grabbing her credit card, calling up a cab to the train back to Philly, and I was off. And another, like, 6 years went by, and I hit 30, and then again, this family just won't leave me alone. And I'm like, I'm at 30. And life is terrible. I mean, just brutal. I'm living alone. My sister, like, kicked me out. I finally found a place. A friend brought me in. And he left because he didn't want anything to do with me. He's like, you can have the lease. I was above the landlord, so the landlord knew me. And somehow I was able to charm him into letting me stay. And I lived in this, like, two-bedroom empty apartment. So I started buying things, you know, thinking, like, I got to set this place up real nice. And I remember in inventory talking to my sponsor about how things were, like, mocking me in my house. And his suggestion was I donate and give stuff away. And I remember I was, like, I gave away, like, a mattress and box spring that still had the plastic on it because I, like, didn't sleep on it. Now, I remember I had, like, furniture that were in boxes. Like, I bought, like, an end table. And I never took it out. I just put the drink on top of the box. You know, because, like, it was, like, it was a joke. It didn't do anything to me. It was just stuff that I accumulated because I thought this was going to do something. You know what I mean? And it didn't. It didn't work at all. And like I said, I hit 30, and life was bad. And my family wanted to talk to me again. You know, like, they were like, please, you know, I remember my mom, like, you know, my baby's turned 30. I want to do something for you. And it was, like, 3 days before my birthday, and they must have had something in the works for a while because, like, I walk out the door, and there's my sister. And she's like, Paul, you know, we've been trying to get a hold of you. Like, can you please see us on your birthday? You know, everyone is asking. I was like, all right, well, what do I have to do? And they're like, you know, just have dinner with, you know, it was my brother-in-law, her, my stepfather, and my mom, and that's it. You know, just that. And I was like, all right, fine. And I remember May 9th of 2009, like, waking up for the first time and, like, really praying, like, not to get drunk. Just, God, don't let me drink today. And I got loaded. And and I showed up. That's how it is. It's like I would pray for things like that, like pray like not to drink, and like it was so fleeting. It was so fast. It was like gone. I remember this is the worst fear. I can't show up to this thing drunk, and then boom, I'm loaded. And I remember walking into this, and I knew what was going on. It was a big surprise party, and there's like all these people, and I was already like in the tank, and it's upsetting to me like when I think about it a lot, because like I don't remember much of like my 20s. I don't remember 20 to 30 really. I remember these incidents, these moments, these like things. I remember just about like these next couple things from that whole day. Like I remember like having my head on the table, the head of the table, like 35 people with my head on it, reading a card in my lap, and I put my chin up on it. And my aunt was to my left, and I remember she mouthed to me, it's okay, we love you. And that set me off. And I flipped. And like cursed them all out in the middle of a restaurant. You know, it was like the record stopped. And I was gone. And I went back to my house, and I was over it. I was out. I couldn't believe that they did this to me. That's what I was saying. I can't believe you guys have to do this, to throw me a party. And it was nuts. And I went home, and I was tying it on, and I went, and Philly's like not that big. And I was walking to a bar, and I passed by my sister's house, and I remember sitting on her stoop, crying, listening to my family play Rock Band inside. Like, I had family members from, like, Pittsburgh, from New York, from all over that came to see me. And I wanted to be with them. And all I could do was sit on the front step and listen and have a good time. And I went down to this place, and I was tying them on. And a mutual friend of mine and my sister's, like, again, Philly's not that big of a city. They contacted her, and they're like, you got to get your brother out of here. And she came down and got me. She brought me home. And, like, once again, I was broke. She paid my tab. I came back to the house with her, and I, you know, gripped her up, took her money, threw her out, and went back out again. You know, and woke up the next day, head spinning, mind going, tears in my eyes before they opened, and swearing, God, please don't let me get drunk. And by 2 o'clock, I'm loaded again. So I remembered what I did. I remembered what I did the night before, you know. But I can't remember with significant force, you know, the humiliation and suffering of, like, even 12 hours before. You know, I can't play the tape to the end. I can play the tape to when, like, I get loaded, that part of it. That's when I play the tape to. I can't keep it green, like, I don't know if I even today necessarily understand what that means. I thought we recycled or something when I came first. I was like, kept hearing, keep it green, keep it green. I'm like, all right, I'm going to keep it green. Like, I'm going to throw my water into, like, but why do we keep using styrofoam? Like it was confusing to me. Like, it just didn't work. But anyway, and that's what happens. Like, you know, I get loaded. I can't do this. I can't accumulate things. Like, things aren't going to keep me sober. You know, and I got my 30th birthday present a few days later. I was walking to work, and my phone's blowing up, and my dad's even calling me. I'm like, why is Dad calling me? And like my aunts again stuff are calling me. I'm like, what is going on? And it was like ridiculous amounts of phone calls. And I remember I checked the first one. I was like, all right, let me hear what's going on. I checked the first voicemail. It was my mom bawling her eyes out. And right around when I got sober, my sister was diagnosed with MS. And they discovered she had MS because, like, she lost her depth perception. She lost, like, control of her eyes. She would look like, it's messed up, but she looked like almost like Cookie Monster. Like, I remember I would go to Will's Eye Center with her, like, today, and, like, she would be, I would laugh at her. I'd be like, Jess, you're looking, like, crazy. But I'd like to, you know, it's all, it's like what a little brother's supposed to do. But, So they say, like, you know, she lost her depth perception. She fell on the stairs, and she's in the hospital. And I remember, like, you know, deleting that message, hang up the phone, turning it off, and saying good. You know, and not because I wanted my sister to be hurt, but just so they would, like, maybe leave me alone for a little bit. You know, maybe, like, just give me a timeout. Like, get away from me. Worry about Jess. Well, as it turns out, my sister does have MS, but that day, like, this was just a part of their ploy. You know, and, like, maybe 15 minutes later, my dad and my stepfather came into the bar that I was working at, and they sat down. And I don't know if you have any experience with fathers and stepfathers, but my experience is that they don't go out to the bar for lunch. You know, they don't have a drink together. It just doesn't happen. So I knew there was something was up. And I went down and I got the manager on duty. And I was like, you know, that's my dad and my stepdad. I think I'm going to rehab. And he was like, all right, cool, man. And I was like, it was like no surprise. And I left, and sure enough, they drove me back to the house. And it was my sister's place, and all those people that were there on May 9th were now there on, like, May 13th for my intervention. And this time, I didn't want to hear any stories. Just wanted to go. You know, part of me just wanted to break, and I didn't choose that day as my sobriety date. I didn't go into, like, rehab thinking I was, like, never going to drink again. I didn't come out of rehab thinking I wasn't going to drink again. Like, God chose that for me, you know. And I had a lot of fear about that, about going in there, and you know, like, the family's members have shown me, like, Alcoholics Anonymous shows me, when I give my love to God, when I give my will to God, like, I commence to outgrow fear. But I went in, and I was scared, but I went in, and you know, I got 30 days, you know, I gained some weight, felt good, came back out, you know, hit back up to Philly, you know, no money, nothing, no job. But, man, I made, like, I did 180 and 90, and I went to a lot of meetings, and I got a temporary sponsor, and this is another one you guys might be able to fill me in on. Like, I didn't know what that was, really. I got a temporary one. I don't know. I guess I was interested in temporary sobriety. You know, I was interested in it being very convenient for me. He told me I had to call him every day, and he's a good friend, close to my heart. I love this guy. But we weren't really doing much except talk on the phone every now and then. Like, I was giving him a bunch of drama, and he was like, you know, telling me that, you know, we're going to get working soon, and it was working out for me, but you know, but I didn't turn into a winner, you know what I mean? Like all of a sudden, like, I didn't stop, like, doing the things I did. If anything, I got, like, much worse, you know. I was still lying, still cheating, still. I was going to bars, but I was being, like, you know, king of the drunks. You know, I was, like, sober and, like, you know, manipulating people, like, to, like, come home with me. I would tell the girl, but, you know, I'm sober. I'm actually a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to get out now because I got to hit a meeting. And it was, like, just total chaos. And I was getting really scared, and I figured I better get out of Dodge. But I had no money. So I did, like, things that I'm, like, pretty good at doing. And I, like, wrote a check from PNC. And I went at, like, 2 o'clock in the morning. And, like, back then you could, like, get half of the money out. So I was ready for like $1,000, and I deposited into Commerce, and I take $500 out from the ATM, and I did Commerce to like Citibank for like $2,000. I took $1,000 out, and I like that's how I did it. And I had this big boatload of cash, and I was like, what am I going to do? I was like, I better get to a meeting. So I go to a meeting. I went to the Center City meeting, and I went down to the Rittenhouse Square afterwards, and we were all hanging out, talking, And I let everyone go home. I, like, rode my bike back, and I'm riding my bike back, and I turned, I circled back around, I locked it up, and I waited in the alley across from this bar I used to work at that I still had the keys to. I waited for everyone to clear out, and I unlocked the door, and I went back in. I walked by 2 fully loaded bars right up to that register, right up to the drop, and took that home with me. I was back in my house, and I was freaking out. And I called up my buddy, and I was like, dude, I can't do the sponsor stuff. This isn't working. And I went to this video store that was closing down. I was buying it up, watching a lot of movies in early sobriety. And I ran into this guy that I didn't really like too much. He talked about God a lot, and I didn't want to hear anything about that. That seemed like a little bit of hocus-pocus to me. And I always had this, you know, I went to Catholic school, and I always knew, like, I was in this pain of, like, hating myself. And I remember, like, going to, like, First Friday Mass with the class, and, like, I think we went every Wednesday or like 2 weeks, 2 Wednesdays a month. And I remember like trying to pray and like looking at him like, why are people are doing this praying thing? And like, God's not listening to me. So from the start, I thought this was just fake, you know, and I was like, man, you know, he's like, how you doing? And I was like, he's like all jolly and happy. I'm like, I'm all right, man, you know, just getting to the movies. And he asked me about, like, you know, what I was doing in 12 steps. And I was like, I'm not really doing too much. He's like, you want to? And I was like, yeah, sure. He's like, so you want to be my sponsor? And he's like, yeah, all right, what are you doing right now? I'm like, I'm buying movies. He's like, well, I live across the street. And I was like, oh, okay, what was that supposed to mean? He's like, well, let's go do this. And in the next hour or so, we sat there. He smoked a lot of cigarettes, and we read a book. And, I think the big book might have been the first book I read since I was, like, 5, like, all the way through. And today I can actually read books. It's pretty amazing. It's another one of gifts of sobriety. And today I, like, read a book, and I, like, I can look at it, and I can say that's interesting. And I can find, like, some separation. Oh, that's neat. But the big book was just like me. It was spot on. I, like, understood everything. He explained to me, like, I'm powerless not because, like, I, you know, lose my money or I pee myself or I wake up in jail. It's like I'm powerless because, like, I drink and I can't stop. And if I stop, I can't stay stopped without God. And I understood that. And I remember, like, just wanting to leave, and he's like, hold on. And we went down to the coffee shop, and he got coffee, and then, like, we ran into another guy from AA. We hang out at coffee shops near meetings, and we started reading some more, and there I am on South Street, which is a pretty popular street in Philadelphia, right off it, and I'm kneeling down, holding these guys' hands, saying this prayer. And I was like, what is going on? And he said he got 72 hours. And he's like, write a 4-step and come back. And I had a spreadsheet that I, like, did on my own before, and I was checking things, and I thought that was going to be good, but he didn't really want to buy into that. And so I wrote this thing, and there it was, and I thought I understood what was going to happen here. I knew, like, there was some faults there, but I didn't think it was going to be like this. And here I am writing why I'm resentful of this person and what they did to me and how it affects me, and there's the truth right there. But the truth is that third column is my truth, not the truth. And my truth is very subjective. All about me, and you know, my truth has me doing a lot of great things, and people really doing some evil things to me, and it's all hurtful and hateful against Paul. And then he showed me the truth, my hand and stuff, what I bring to the table on my own without God, and that selfishness, dishonesty, self-centeredness, and fear—a whole lot of fear. You know, we look at fear a lot. I like to explore fear. I can't play the tape to the end, but I can play the fear backwards. You know, fear stole so much from me. I didn't understand that. I asked my current sponsor, how is fear stealing? He said, well, look at your life. You know, I talked about how, like, I didn't know what you guys wanted. I had to rely on you to make me who I was, so I told you lies. So every relationship I had in my life was based on self-centered fear, so it was stolen by fear. There was no truth in that. Every relationship I had. I relied upon things. It was much easier for me to believe to come to believe in the power of a new pair of shoes, or a new jacket, or maybe a new paycheck, or maybe another zero at the end of my paycheck, or whatever it might be, a car. Like, that would restore me to sanity, not God. I constantly want to make the fallible divine and the divine fallible. You know, that's easy for me to believe. So my possessions owned me. I didn't own my possessions. So I didn't even have a relationship with material things. I didn't know what it was. Today, I like to try to think, I like to try to believe, I like to try to work to live spiritually in a material world. You know, walk through this spiritual life. And of course, like, I didn't know who I was. It's basing myself on self-centered fear and lies. So it stole from me a relationship from myself. And most importantly, the relationship that if I don't have, I lose everything. Relationship with God. You know, I currently know what it's like to be a son. Because I know what it is like to be a brother, to be a future husband, to be a godfather. Because I know what love is, I know what peace is, I know what forgiveness is. Because I know God. Without God, I don't know what any of those things are. Quickly become consumed with myself, driven by fear. And I'm going to step on the toes of others, and they're going to retaliate. And I'm going to think it's your fault. That's how I go. And anyway, he showed me this fourth column. And even the ones I thought were the doozies, like, yo, how are you going to show me on this one? What you got there? And he showed me, well, how old are we? How old are you, man? I'm like, I'm 30 years old. He's like, when did this happen? It's like, I was 12. It's like, all right. How about that one? And And then, you know, we looked at these shortcomings, and I realized I had a lot of things to do. I had to get to this step, the only step I understood. I remember like not going to bed in rehab and being in the community center and pushing like all the furniture off from, because I laid in the middle of the room. And I remember these things on either side. I remember reading these steps, and the only one I knew what was going to happen was like number 9. Like I knew I was made direct amends with people. Like this is going to be brutal. And I just wasn't going to do it. Here I go, you know, like when faced with alcoholic destruction, I become open to spiritual things. And this is where things like really took off for me. I went back home and I prayed after that fifth step, and I looked at it, I took that hour and I looked at those suggestions, and I explored my life thoroughly. You know, an unexplored life is not worth living. I felt as if I was finding facts and facing facts and taking inventory, and I currently still take inventory, but a business that is constantly taking inventory is not open, but a business that doesn't take regular inventory cannot open either. So I continue to look at myself, and I go home, and then I made this list of amends I'm going to have to make, and it wasn't like my fourth step to my eighth. It was a new one because I didn't have to resent you necessarily to have harmed you. And I had amazing gifts again, amazing gifts. Pain came, it's painstaking, but I was amazed before I was halfway through. You know, and those promises that we'll read at the end of a lot of meetings, I said, we think not, you know, and I wasn't doing anything. And I was attaining these things on my own. All of a sudden, like, I realized what a liar I was in AA, thinking I attained some of these things, you know. And if you're believing that you're not at this point, and you are, wait till God starts really doing that stuff for you, not you thinking you are. And I remember going to my mom and like thinking like this is going to be an easy one. I want to do this, and all of a sudden I'm shaking, I'm crying. I'm like, well, I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she's like, oh, and I'm thinking like this is going to be fantastic. And then I'm like, is there anything else? And her like, yes, there are. And boom. And she let me have it right back. You know, and I can only see such a little bit. You know, all the times I build up hope and dreams with lies that she could just pull back down on her. You know, I never knew it hurt my mom to hear from, like, my neighbor or from neighbors from the old neighborhood that, yo, your son is running around like a madman. You know, I never knew it hurt her, like, that I was in physical pain. You would think I would know, but I had no idea. And, my sister, you know, again, who I stole from, robbed like crazy, just manipulated, who was in closer relationship. I had that same inner workings and circles as I did, and, like, just was devastated by, like, my whole life, saying, like, you know what you can do? You can be a good godfather. And, like, today I am in my nephew's life. And it's, like, just a blessing and a gift. Like, I can stand here and say that life is good. And that's like the furthest thing from anything I would ever think that this alcoholic would ever experience. Like life is good. And I went back to even to that place I robbed, sober. And I remember I went in and I had like the same money that I stole. Just about, I think it was like the same bills. And I asked for the owners, who were friends of mine, good friends of mine. I was at his wedding. Like sober, I was at his wedding, and I was like, "Are these guys there?" And the woman's like, "No, they're not. But can I help you? They're actually out in Belgium on a beer tour." And I was like, "Yeah, I guess so. My name's Paul, and is there anywhere we can talk?" And she said, "Oh, I know you. Yeah, you used to work here." And we went up to the office, and I explained everything, and I was willing to do time or whatever they're going to have to do. And I said, "Of course, I'll come back when." And my friends are here, and I'll make amends again. And I was like, "Is there anything else I can do?" And she was like, "You know what? Yeah." And she said her son was at Livingren, and that's a rehab in Bucks County, and that their blackout period was coming up at this weekend. And could I talk to her about Alcoholics Anonymous? And like again, I was blown away. Here I am, like I'm there. You know, I am making amends. To, like, help me get free of the past. But, man, like, God has put me in a position to be useful to. I can only see so many things. I think that I can see all the way at the end of the line, you know. I think I know what's going to make me happy, what I need to get. You know, and the truth is, like, I don't know if I know what's going to make me happy, like today. Like, sometimes I get something I've been dreaming of, and I'm like, this is terrible. Like, I want out. And sometimes, like, I think it's the worst curse in the world, and it's a gift. It's a gift, you know. I just have to ask God to help me open it, you know what I mean? Like, I know that if I live in the dictates of a higher power of my God, that I will currently live in a great world no matter what my current circumstance. Like, this is a promise to me, and it comes true, but I still, like, deny it. Still don't think it can happen, you know. I still fight with it. But here I am, you know, returning money from something I've stolen, how I've robbed people of security, you know, of respect to my friends, sober. And here I am, like, talking about Alcoholics Anonymous to this woman. Blows me away. And my sponsor, because the right after that, my sponsor, he relapsed. And I say that because he put my hand in the hand of God. And, like, the book talks about like, this, you know, we are, like, comrades after shipwreck. And, like, that this is one of the powerful things that binds us, but the solution is the thing that keeps us together. And my current sponsor tells me, like, get attracted to the journey, not the fellowship, because it does change. And I asked that guy to sponsor me. I was going to go, my thinking, I don't have many good ideas, and I was thinking, like, it might be a good idea for me to, like, fly on my own for a little bit, you know. And I remember I went to this, like, meeting in Center City, and I said, if this guy's there, I'm going to ask him to be my sponsor. And I asked him, And he made me go through the steps right away again. I was like, oh, gosh. And anyway, we went back through them. And he showed words like, you know, next we launch. And he showed me, like, you know, as we clean up the past, we commence to keep cleaning up things as we go. And he keeps me in a life of 10, 11, and 12, you know. I understand that if I'm not growing, I'm going. I said, like, you know, I don't knock sayings in AA, you know, and there's a lot of truth to them. Like, I would never tell a newcomer to go hang out, like, in a bar. And as a person, I did not watch the Eagles last night at a bar drinking a club soda. But I can if I wanted to, you know. I would just pray. But I wouldn't want to be there, you know what I mean? I would never tell anyone to go hang out in North Philly, Kensington, or Camden. You know, an addict or not an addict, or a drunk or not a drunk. Like, I just wouldn't do it. It's just not a good idea. But so I don't knock those things, but I don't necessarily have a lot of experience with them. But I do know if you're not growing, you're going. You know, I don't try to maintain. They're not my maintenance steps to me. This is about growth. You know, what am I currently doing? What's going on right now? Am I looking at my fear? I'm currently actually slacking on going through the steps again. I just don't want to write. I'm lazy still. I don't like work. Sometimes I look at myself and I have this great inventory, and then he says, like, you know, I think you just don't like work. I'm like, yeah, thanks. Yeah, that's true. Still today, you know, just don't like to put the effort in a lot. You know, I can't see the simple truth sometimes. But you know, I try to keep working. And this 10-step shows me just how much I need God. I hear people sometimes, like, say, like, oh, well, you just keep knocking yourself down. You keep knocking yourself. Like, keep taking it easy on yourself. And the truth is, like, yeah, I know. Like, I'm not cutting myself, you know. But like, I just show myself how I still need God in everything in my life. I still, like, have not had a symptom-free week. You know, and I still slack on things, you know, because my ego is huge, you know, like, and sometimes, like, I have to make sure that my God is still as big as my ego, because I'll look at things, I'll be like, man, I am not telling this man this again. I'm not talking about this one more time. I am almost 5 years sober. I should not still have this problem. And then again, there's my truth. That's Paul running on his ego. You know, there's no God in that. There's no spirituality in that. You know, that's not what this program's about. And I can carry this into my 11th step, you know, my morning meditation, my evening meditation, my prayer life, which to me is, like, that's the hardest step for me. You know, I pray a lot, man. I don't meditate naturally. It's just not something for me. But it works. You know, sometimes I'm like, yeah, I'm filled with gossip. Well, how's your meditation life? It's not existent. Well, that's making a lot of sense, huh? You know, like that's what happens. And, you know, hopefully I can, with this work, you know, with going back through these steps, you know, with still having, like, all the, like, you know, the suffering of a drowning man, you know, still keeping that in my current life, even when I can say with utmost sincerity that life is divine. You know, I still got to keep that desperation, you know, all that willingness. I can carry that so I can stay spiritually awoken. You know, my sponsor says a lot, we can fall back asleep and think we can walk through this life, you know, asleep thinking we're awake. You know, that's not my practice. It's not what I try to do. You know, I can be convinced that I'm like, you know, I'm going to reach out to a newcomer. I'm going to sponsor a new guy, but I haven't done anything. You know, I can't transmit something that I'm not currently having. And I can't, you know, rely on a spiritual experience I had a year ago. And what am I currently doing? You know, you better call me at this time, young man, and you better have this written, but I'm not doing a thing. All I'm doing is transmitting untreated alcoholism, because I am always alcoholic. You know, it's almost like the low blow. You know, my life is fantastic, but I'm still alcoholic. You know, and that's, I still have all these things, because I have to get down to the causes and conditions. You know, like I said, I didn't stop drinking back in 09 and become a winner. You know, I have to work on this thing. And that keeps me practicing these principles in all my affairs. And that's, like, sometimes the biggest challenge. You know what I mean? Like, when I'm driving up here and I've never been here before and I'm trying to fly, you know? And, like, there's somebody in front of me. You know, and all I want to do is, like, beep. You know, come on, get out of my way. You know, or if I'm at work and, you know, somebody at two tops sits at a four top and I'm like, all right, we got a line. You know, like, where's God in that when I'm yelling at somebody? Or, you know, like the biggest example is my fiance today, you know. Another one of those core beliefs that were removed by God, you know, a core belief that I will always be alone. You know, that I should be alone. That real men don't, like, stand in front of people and say that I'm in love with somebody, or that I love having a woman in my life, or that I need a woman in my life. But, you know, ask her how my 10-step is. I made the worst mistake, and she invited her to the Fellowship of the Spirit conference this summer. She's using a lot of my terms back at me. Now she's suggesting prayer and meditation today. I don't know what I got myself into. We'll see. But, you know, I have to practice these principles in all my affairs. It's nice to come up here and to speak for an hour. What am I going to do on the drive home, you know? I'm a blessed person. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a divine, divine place. And have a happy holiday, guys. Thank you very much.